Hey, Cloudcast listeners, before we get to today's show, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor. Today's sponsor is Datadog. Now, you know we've been talking about Datadog for a while now. It's the monitoring platform for cloud-scale infrastructure and applications. But did you know that Datadog seamlessly integrates with your AWS environments? So you can start monitoring EC2, RDS, ECS, and all your other AWS services in minutes. You can visualize key metrics, set alerts to identify anomalies, and collaborate with your team to troubleshoot and fix issues fast. So if you want to figure out how Datadog can help your AWS environment, try it yourself for free by starting a free 14-day trial today. If you go to datadog.com/cloudcast, not only can you start your free 14-day trial, but you get a free Datadog t-shirt. So go out to datadog.com/cloudcast, sign up for your free 14-day trial, start monitoring your AWS environment, and get your free t-shirt. And now, on to the show.
Cloudcast Media presents from the Massive Studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. This is The Cloudcast with Aaron Delp and Brian Gracely, bringing you the best of cloud computing from around the world.
Good morning, good evening, wherever you are. Welcome back to The Cloudcast. We are coming to you live from the Massive Cloudcast Studios here in Raleigh, North Carolina. And folks, before we get into it, I'm going to apologize up front. The wonderful golden fog of pollen has descended on North Carolina. It is killing my voice today. So I apologize for the graveliness of it. The good news is when you're the host, you don't have to talk that much. And so, you know, one of the things we do a lot on this show is we get a lot of startups that are SaaS companies. We tend to talk a lot about the plumbing underneath the cloud all the time, but very rarely do we ever kind of go behind the scenes on SaaS, kind of business models and how SaaS works and that stuff. So very excited today to bring back a longtime friend of the show, Anil Lakhani. Let's just sort of get started because you have been very involved with SaaS companies for quite a while. So for folks that don't know you for some reason, which they should, give us a little bit of your background.
Sure. Awesome. As Brian said, my name is Anil. I've been in tech for going on 22 years now, and I started out at companies like IBM and Cisco and did a brief stint at Gartner as an analyst and have since been working at startups. So my introduction to SaaS companies was at Gartner because I was pitched by SaaS companies during the main part where software was transitioning to a software as a service model. So after seeing and comparing business models between different kind of software companies, I got sucked into the startup world and have been at SaaS companies for the last 7 years.
Yeah, no, and you and I have known each other for probably more than a decade. We worked briefly together at Cisco. We were doing some marketing-ish stuff for data centers. I will say there's two things that I always admire about you. One is you are incredibly humble about being a very sort of brilliant and curious person. And the other thing is you are the only person I know, I think, in any given sitting can sit down and eat more barbecue than me. Given sitting, you have the greatest stomach for somebody who you'd never know. So
I take immense pride in that second one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, listen, the reason we wanted to talk today was I was watching some Twitter feed about a week or two ago, and this conversation started up about SaaS. And really, it was kind of about delivering software and building companies. And you sort of made this statement. You said, SaaS changes everything. And I thought, that's a perfect topic. Let's talk about why SaaS companies that deliver software as a service, whatever that might be, are different than kind of traditional software companies. So if somebody was saying like, hey, explain the difference to me, what are the most basic starting points that you would explain to people who maybe know the software world as, downloadable software as opposed to SaaS?
Sure. I would really break it down to two fundamental things. First is that every claim you make and everything you have to say about your product is immediately subject to judgment and scrutiny in real life. So it's not like you're making a claim about something that someone's going to get their hands on some months from now and there's going to be a professional services team that does a deployment and make sure everything goes right. Any claim you make, someone will start a free trial, and that process takes minutes, and they'll experience whether or not your claim is true. This has a huge upstream impact on not just how you talk about software and the words you use to sell it and the ways you convince people into buying it, but also in what and how you build software and how you prioritize your roadmap.
Right.
Because everything is immediately visible to the customer.
Yeah, no, that's that. Starting from there is sort of fascinating because you're right. So much of like enterprise software is about some promise and some dream, and don't worry, we'll get there, and it's on the roadmap. And you're right, SaaS is all about literally probably that first 5 minutes of experience. Does it do what you say it's going to do? Now, it may not be as feature rich, but does it say what you said it's going to do?
Yeah, and there's another thing, which is that the model of how money arrives to you is different. Most people who buy SaaS products, even if you're a very large company and you've got, you know, $1 billion in revenue or more, the way you tend to buy SaaS products when you're starting out with something is on a month-to-month basis or on a relatively short contract relative to how you buy perpetual software licenses, where you'll lock in a license for 3 years or 5 years or 10 years. In the SaaS world, even if you're a huge company, when you're trying out a new product for the first time, you know, you'll buy in for 3 months, maybe 6 months, maybe you'll go month to month. On the outside, you'll go for a year.
Yeah, and you're picking between, you know, the free tier, the one that has a few features, the one that has a lot of features. You're ultimately basically dependent on, you know, as an end user or a chooser, you're dependent on that one chart that every website has that says, here's the free tier, here's the nice tier, yep, and here's the super premium one. You're looking at the checkboxes and you're like, do I want to pay for any of those?
Yeah. So to me, the net result of these two things are that the experience that the customer has and the users have is dramatically elevated in software as a service businesses.
Gotcha. So let's talk a little bit about, let's start sort of on the, let's say the sales side of those two things, right? So there was a sales and kind of getting money aspect of it. We'll talk about the development aspect of it. Kind of walk through, you know, you put your first service out there, you get the domain, you put the first service out there, you hope that people come to it through various means. And, you know, these days it feels like everything sort of has to start with some free 14-day trial. Like, kind of walk us through how SaaS companies are figuring out how to get from awareness to people signed up for the trial to, you know, we can start requesting that they sign up for something that pays money and then go from there. How do you keep them in, you know, loving the software, I guess?
Yeah. So this is something I actually talk about a lot with startup founders in my consulting business, where I help them figure these things out. So the when people think about SaaS, they tend to think about a bottoms up model, which is, you know, the world of how Salesforce started. It's New Relic, how New Relic started, how a lot of what are now public equity SaaS companies got their start, which is you have a free trial that a single staff level contributing member of some team that's targeted can afford and expense. And that's how everything starts. So it's always individual team members or small teams. And then from there, you attempt to grow the business over time as it spreads to multiple teams. And or if you go in with a sales rep that says, hey, you've got 10 different teams at your company using this product, why don't we roll all of that into a single deal and we'll give you a large discount? So that's the most typical way people think about SaaS models. But that's not actually the only way things work. You can still have outside sales. You still have people calling down and targets and doing whale hunting. You still have, you know, sales engineers and sales reps of all kinds and SDRs, like all the various ways people sell and do sales still applies in SaaS. It's just how the account and the customer goes through the process of acquiring the product, understanding it, and then using it is different.
Right. So obviously, you know, in traditional software sales, you go in through some way. Maybe you went in through the IT team, you went in through a business user, and then, you know, your goal is always, I want to sell higher in the organization. I want to become sort of the de facto standard within that. With SaaS, because the buying model could start anywhere, right? Like you said, it could be an individual user, how do companies think about it then at that point? Is it still similar to, you know, we're happy to get in the door any way we can? You know, how do we keep track of, is Becky part of Acme Corporation, or is she just herself because she signed up? You know, like, how do companies rectify all that or kind of rationalize all that?
Yeah, so I'll talk about it in two different ways. First, I'll talk about the how you think about your funnel for this and how you think about the sales process, and then I'll talk about the actual mechanics. Yep. So typically, most SaaS businesses, so a disclosure, I primarily focus on B2B enterprise kind of software as a service, right? So in that universe, most businesses choose to go for a land and expand model, which is, you know, you get whatever deal you can, and then through a great experience, you expand it over time. So, you know, you will take a very small 3-month or 6-month deal in the anticipation that that'll grow as there's more usage or people really realize the value as they use the product within their own environment.
Gotcha.
So that's what's most standard. However, there are plenty of companies that will actually go in and only do large deals. There are at least 5 companies I could name off the top of my head that don't do deals under $100,000, period. They don't even bother. So you know, it doesn't have to be that way. What I found is that the actual sales motion for every individual product can be completely different, even if they're within the same, competing for the same dollars in the same segment with similar products.
Right, right. Well, and that's not unusual. We see that with regular software as well. You know, some people go after premium margins, and others are willing to sort of live in the bottom. It depends what your focus is and all.
And then the mechanics of doing what you talked about was more about when you have an inbound funnel and you have an inside sales motion and things are, you know, content or SEO and then advertising SEM driven or free trial driven. How do you keep that funnel together and know what cohorts are doing what? So in the beginning, most companies do it manually with spreadsheets and a little bit of Google Analytics and a little bit of Salesforce, and maybe they're using MailChimp or what have you before they get sophisticated technical systems to do this. In my view, you can do everything with a spreadsheet, and when it gets too big for you to keep track of stuff with the spreadsheet is when you should stop.
Yeah. Now I've seen, and I don't follow this closely enough, so I'm going to kind of ask you ignorantly. You know, I watch some of the VCs that invest in this space, and there's always certain metrics they look at in terms of, you know, monthly recurring revenue, number of users. Like, what are some of those sort of key milestones that, whether you're the founder of the business or let's say you're the investor in that SaaS business, that you're sort of looking at in terms of ramp up? Like, what are the, you know, there's always probably 5 or 6 things they're always looking at. You know, what's your burn rate? How many users do you have? How are you monetizing? But like, what are some of those key metrics or thresholds they look at?
Yeah. So at the most basic, you want to know how many leads are you getting? How many of those leads are converting to paying customers? What is your average deal size or your annual contract value? What is your average selling price? And what is your churn rate, right? So month over month, are the customers you've acquired, are they net leaving or are you net adding more? And then very closely related to that is what's your revenue retention? So of the customers you have, are you growing your revenue on a monthly basis or are you shrinking it? So another term people will use is churn or negative churn. So what people want to see is negative churn, right? But not only are you not losing the customer that you booked last month, this month, or 6 months from now, but that same customer is growing their usage of your product such that they generate more revenue.
Right. Right. That makes sense.
So these are the sort of the basic things. As someone who specializes in marketing, I also care about a few other things. I really care about customer acquisition costs. So I want to know how much money it takes per, you know, for me to get a customer, which is different from how much money it takes for me to get a lead, right? Because a lot fewer leads turn into customers than you have at the top of the funnel. I also really care about the sales cycle, right? Ideally, you know, you're trying to drive the sales cycle down so you're not spending 60 or 90 or 180 days trying to convince someone to become a customer. You should be spending 30 days to convince someone to become a customer, or 14 days in an awesome business to convince someone to be a customer. And all of these things are proxies for how well marketing is doing its job. You know, if your lead quality is high, then your conversion rate should be high, your sales cycle should be lower, your ACV should be higher, et cetera.
Right. And what are the kind of best practices these days for the marketing side of this in terms of, you know, getting your message out there? You know, is it a lot of SEO? Is it, you know, is it important to get on those like early Gartner lists? I mean, what are those key things if you're an early marketer going like, okay, I have a certain amount of money and I have a whole bunch of ways I could get to people. Like, what are the most common sort of best ones these days?
Yeah, they haven't changed. Honestly, they haven't changed in the last decade. For my world, which is mostly B2B software, mostly enterprise kind of software as a service products, you have to know where your customers are and where they spend their time and where they hang out. So, you know, in a lot of cases, you have to have great content, great SEO. You have to participate in the events where your, you know, customers go to learn about the things that are, you know, that are relevant to what you do and the, you know, and are part of the world that you sell into. You also have to speak their language. And, you know, then assuming all of these things hold, then you layer on AdWords and SEM so that when they're searching for solutions that are specific, they find you. You advertise on and or sponsor relevant podcasts and websites where people get information and have communities and are looking to solve problems. And then you make sure that you have validation. You have independent market validation. So the things that people look for more than anything else is peer validation. Are other people in my industry with my title solving the problems I'm trying to solve using this product? Are there people who I look up to who would recommend this product? And if I went out to a networking event that has all the other VP of engineerings like I am for such and such kinds of companies, would a handful of them recommend this company and this product? And a proxy for that is analysts, right? If you're a very large company and you've got a whole procurement department and people rely on analysts as guidance about which technologies or which companies are good to do business with, then you have to, you know, have analyst relations and make sure that the analysts have a good view of your marketing and your positioning and your product and what it offers to the marketplace.
Yeah. One other thing I always wonder about is, you know, SaaS is like you said, it's a different model. You may be paying by the month, you may be paying every couple of weeks or by the year. I mean, it's just a different buying model. And I know when I talk to companies who begin using the public cloud, let's say AWS, and they're using infrastructure, there's always some kind of shock to the system of understanding how much it costs, because in their, say, on-prem world, they just think about cost differently. Like, it's a big PO, or they don't have to take, like, how does that work in the SaaS world? Is there still sort of a shock to the system when people go, oh, wait a second, do I want to spend $4 a month per person per, like, how have you found successful companies navigate sort of like explaining price to people?
I would say it was a shock to the system. And it is no longer a shock to the system. So the only time I encounter price-oriented resistance today when selling SaaS products is in government, in municipal or federal government situations, or in industries where the primary spend on technology purchasing is still considered capital expenses, where they want a depreciating asset over time.
Gotcha.
And so that's very common in municipal and the federal government, and it's very common in certain other industries where they're just less likely to buy SaaS at any scale.
I gotcha. That makes sense.
But for the most part, the only objections I've had price wise for a SaaS product have to do with how it compares to other similar products. Right? Are you more or less than so and so other SaaS product?
Right. I gotcha. Okay. Let's switch gears a little bit, talk about the software side of the house, the development side of the house. You know, it seems to me sort of the first immediate thing that's very, very different about this is not only are you creating software, hopefully that, like you said, delights customers and does interesting things, but you have to run that. And to run that is by no means free. And it's not, you know, regression testing like you did with kind of package software. How do you, like, do you find like that people have to have failed in a previous SaaS environment as an engineering team to sort of understand how important that is? Or do people get that going in that they've got to factor that into their, like, that has to be a very different world for engineering teams, unless they somehow came from that background.
No matter how much they factor it in, even if they've come from that background, even if they've done it multiple times, every engineering team I've seen will inevitably end up kicking operability and operational cans down the road to prioritize shipping product features until it's a necessity to do otherwise.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I work with very sophisticated teams that have deep experience in software as a service, and that's true even there.
Yeah. Well, and I have to imagine it gets pretty complicated. I mean, you've worked with some companies who do a lot around, or you know, had done a lot around things like data ingestion and doing analytics on that. I mean, that can potentially become a very costly thing. And if you don't understand how to optimize that, you know, profitability kind of goes out the window. What do some of those internal discussions look like when you're thinking like, how do we prioritize features versus, you know, do people? Obviously, there's lots of marketing folks who go, these are great features. Our competitors do this. Our customers are asking for it. Like, have people gotten good enough at going like, yes, but this is what those features cost? Or is it still just, let's see if people love it and use it, and then we'll optimize as we go along?
So what I've found is that we are in probably the second or third widespread generation of engineers, operators, engineers who operate, operators who engineer, where you can actually have a reasonable discussion about the cost of supporting a feature when you're building it, right? Where, hey, the dangerous thing here is not that we build this and no one uses it. The dangerous thing is that we build it and it takes off.
Right. It scales. It goes up really fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think people are pretty well aware now that that the cost of supporting and maintaining a new feature can be enormous.
Right. And are you finding more and more, I mean, so I would guess almost all of these SaaS companies these days end up, you know, building on top of an Amazon, a Google, an Azure, some set of core services. Do you find that there's more interest or inclination to just use the native services that are in that cloud that you're in, or are people, you know, do they use them when they're sort of non-differentiating, but then they build, you know, some advanced thing on top of it? Like, what do you find sort of as the trade-off or the priority of use that native service so we can keep moving versus I got to build something myself?
Yeah, it's all over the map. For instance, no matter how many times people tell each other that they shouldn't write their own database, they always end up writing their own database.
Yeah.
It is actually all over the map. I have yet to see a consistent pattern. The only consistent pattern I've seen is that people are more than willing to use undifferentiated commodity services from cloud providers. They're very wary of using the higher end custom services that lock them into any particular cloud provider. I mean, from my perspective, one of the reasons for the rise of Kubernetes, for instance, is that if you use, you know, if you build your own services and you choose to run all those services on something like Kubernetes, it is a lot less work to switch underlying infrastructure providers.
Yeah, that makes sense. Whether that's feasible all the time or not, at least in theory, it makes sense. It's kind of the possibility of multi-cloud if you ever need it someday.
Yeah.
How much are we seeing, we always sort of joke around, we play this game when reInvent comes along, who's going to get disrupted? Some things feel like they're, the more adjacent they are immediately to an AWS service or, an Azure service, it's kind of right in a line between infrastructure and some sort of DevOpsy tool. Those feel like that. I mean, what's the mindset in SaaS companies? Is that something they worry about, or is there still kind of, when companies get started, there's a lot of bravado of like, hey, what we're doing is so much better. We don't have to worry about them doing some basic service, or is that becoming more of a concern and people are focusing more and more up the stack, more application centric stuff?
I have yet to meet founders who really exhibit any anxiety about this. Plenty of investors exhibit anxiety about this, but not any founders, really. What I've found with Amazon anyway, and you should go talk to someone at Amazon about this, is that if you're a startup who's built a thing on Amazon and it's very popular and very successful, Amazon wins.
Right.
They win because you use more of Amazon. They also win because you become a proof point for Amazon. They also win because maybe some slice of your customers are on Amazon and you're helping those customers be successful. So Amazon might win three times over if you build your thing on Amazon without them trying to compete with you.
Yeah.
Now, if you're doing a thing that's very successful and you're not using Amazon and it's a service Amazon could offer, then they're not winning because you're winning right now. And it's, they can build a business case for building you. And Amazon has the capacity to build pretty much anyone's anything.
Right.
So I would, I would be more concerned in that case. But Amazon has been known to build features. The cloud providers have been known to build features or services that compete directly with things that are built on top of them, which if they have a customer demand for, they would certainly do. If 10 big customers approach Amazon and say, hey, we're using this third party for this thing and they're running it on Amazon, we'd rather just get it from you directly, Amazon might build that.
Right. Yeah. And I think that always feels like the thing that, it's the trade-off of, like you said, Amazon, if you build on Amazon, Amazon wins for a lot of reasons, i.e. you use their compute, you store their data, you become sticky. But at the same time, yeah, you do have the, hey, we're already paying for other stuff here in Amazon. How far along, how long would it take for you to replace service X? So,
yep.
Well, let me ask you this, because I know we're getting kind of long in the show. We've covered a lot of different things. Let me flip it around just a little bit. You work with a lot of companies. You've had some experience with different SaaS companies, some successful, some less successful. If I were an enterprise buyer and I said, okay, I'm going to go pick Anil's brain about, like, what are some of the tells, from maybe the negative side of things, of going like, these guys on the surface seem pretty good, but I don't know. Like, are there any tells that you find of companies that may not necessarily be successful that would be good for an enterprise buyer to be wary of?
Yeah, so there are things I would look for. The things I would look for are signals that this company will not persist into the future, right? So do they show consistent customer acquisition of logos that are meaningful to me, so that, I feel comfortable participating as part of that ecosystem? And then the second thing I would look for is, what is their competitive ecosystem, right? Is this company one of 250 that are competing for the same dollar to solve the same problem? Or is it one of five? It's more likely to survive if it's one of five, right?
Yeah.
And then the third major thing is, do they know how to service me as a customer? A lot of startups cannot service different kinds of customers. They can only service one kind of customer because everything's built around a single persona or a single market segment or a single buyer type. And if you have needs that deviate from what they've optimized for, are they going to be able to handle you as a customer? Which I've found that the customers that are best at figuring that out are banks. Because a lot of banks have startup programs where they bring in a lot of startups and try them out, and they have a lot of experience with things that haven't worked.
Yeah. Yeah. They're good at breaking stuff and putting complicated requirements on them.
Yep.
Well, very cool. Well, listen, yeah, we may have to have you back at some point in time to talk about that transition that happens. I mean, like, the transition always happens with package software where you go, hey, we had, you know, three or four initial use cases, we got a bunch of customers, and now they want us to go in 10 different directions. Life gets really complicated and so forth. I imagine somewhere that comes up for SaaS companies as well, but I think that's probably a whole different conversation to have.
Absolutely. I'd love to. In every SaaS company's life, there's a moment where you have to choose to not take a customer because that customer will probably destroy your company.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Same problem with every software company they have. Well, listen, Anil, if people want to reach out to you, you know, from a real advice perspective, consulting perspective, or maybe you're going to be speaking at events, what's a good way to get in touch with you?
Twitter is always the best way.
That's right. As soon as you see a coffee logo pop up from at Anil, and go ahead and hit him up. Well, cool, man. It is always great to talk to you. It's good to talk to you about your new level of expertise. Great to have you on the show, folks. As always, you know, for Anil and for Aaron, thank you for listening. Thank you for telling a friend. Thank you for rating the show on iTunes. And so for today's show, apologize for my voice, but we got through it. Thank you for listening this week, and we will talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to The Cloudcast. Please visit thecloudcast.net to find more shows, show notes, videos, and everything social media.